eyes of the world, the eyes of the populations of the world are on you, and we have your numbers.
That lingering sense of fleas remains, and we'll see what comes next.
We need to make sure that what sits there on a piece of paper is actually going to turn into tangible, actionable projects on the ground that are going to make a difference to people's lives.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg Westminster, your daily guide to British politics. I'm Caroline Hepke.
Good afternoon, I'm Ewan Potts. Deputy Prime Minister and Justice Secretary Dominic Raab insists Boris Johnson did not lie to Parliament. It comes after the Prime Minister's former aide Dominic Cummings said he would swear under oath that Boris Johnson was both aware of and allowed a drinks party at number 10 at the height of the pandemic's first lockdown.
But while Raab has said that a Prime Minister found to have deliberately lied to Parliament would, quote, normally resign, he is refusing to comment about whether Johnson should quit.
I'm not going to speculate on hypothetical scenarios. What I am going to do is recognise the importance and the public frustration with any perception and any reality of double standards and let Sue Gray do her job. That's the right thing to do.
So there we go. The common refrain once again is to wait for Sue Gray, the report into Partygate. But Tory backbenchers are still a powder keg and Cummings is upping the ante.
Well, the opposition parties haven't been slow in calling for the Prime Minister to go. The Liberal Democrats have tabled a no-confidence motion in Boris Johnson, arguing that he has broken COVID lockdown laws and, quote, misled both Parliament and the public about it.
Well, reporting in UK newspapers shows that it looks like 18 MPs have signed it, though it does have no legal force. It's not the same as a full no-confidence motion in the government. Joining us now is Sarah Olney, who is Liberal Democrat MP for Richmond Park and the party's business spokesperson. Sarah, thanks for being back with us. On Dominic Cummings, it is such a determined campaign to destroy his former boss, the sheer relentlessness of it, almost movie quality like, sort of makes you feel quite sorry for Boris Johnson.
No, I don't think it does. I think Boris Johnson is in a, you know, and I think this is actually really one of the features of the current crisis. It's very much about Boris. It's about his judgment. It's about his behaviour. It's about things that he has allowed to happen. If Dominic Cummings is just revealing those things to the public, it's still, nevertheless, entirely Boris who's to blame. And, you know, it's not just, I mean, I think we're seeing quite a lot of evidence about what's been going on in Downing Street. A lot of it is hard to refute. There are photographs, there are eyewitness accounts that aren't just Dominic Cummings. We know, obviously, that Sue Gray is going to report on this, so she will presumably put all the evidence that she's found in the public domain. But, you know, as I say, this comes back to Boris. You know, what did he do about it? How did he choose to respond? And I think the important thing is that he's not been... I think it remains to be seen if he's lied to Parliament. I think the evidence certainly seems to demonstrate that he may well have done. But he's certainly not been honest. He was not straightforward in his apology to the Commons last week. He's not been straightforward with anyone about what he did know, what he didn't know. And he's not been straightforward about what exactly happened and what his role was. So, you know, the public are rapidly losing confidence in Boris Johnson. I think Dominic Raab this morning was absolutely right. If he has been found to have lied to the Commons, that makes his position very, very difficult, because we simply cannot function as a democracy if we cannot rely on the Prime Minister to tell the truth to Parliament. But I think it's much more widespread than that. Mm. There is a massive drop-off in confidence amongst the public in the Prime Minister, and that's what's going to make it, in the end, very difficult for him to continue.
Dominic Raab, though, was reluctant to make that point. He was pressed about the issue of whether the Prime Minister should go if he had resigned. And he only made that statement sort of in the hypothetical after quite a number of questions.
Mm. Well, I think that kind of highlights, actually, the reality of the situation that we're in, because Boris Johnson will remain Prime Minister for as long as Tory MPs and members of the Cabinet want him to continue. I don't think there's much... chance of Boris resigning on his own account. So it's up to Tory MPs, and every single one of them, and particularly the members of the Cabinet, like Dominic Raab, have to ask themselves, am I prepared to continue supporting this man to be Prime Minister, or am I going to take action to stop it? And, it, you know, that's what we're all waiting for. Are they prepared to carry on with Boris as Prime Minister or not? The rest of us, I think, as I say, a large number of the public have made up their mind about that, but the rest of us have to wait for them.
And what's your take on whether they will do that? Because the reports are that perhaps 30 letters have gone into the 1922 committee. That is nowhere near 54, is it? It looks like he's pretty safe for now.
I think, and I was chatting to people in the comments about this last night, that the feeling is that a lot of Tory MPs want to hang on until May and see what the local election results are like. And potentially take action then. I think they're probably hampered by there's no obvious successor or no one successor that they can all unite around. So that may well be stopping them. But I'm not getting necessarily the impression that they plan to act soon.
And talking of successors, if he does go, wouldn't Rishi Sunak be more troubling for the opposition parties? Wouldn't that be a problem if the Tories reinvented themselves and presented themselves as a new government with a fresh face? Surely that's the worst case scenario for you.
Well, I mean, we will deal with what's in front of us, as it were. You know, I think I mean, you're right from a tactical point of view. Boris and his massive lack of popularity is quite helpful for the opposition parties. But I mean, I don't want Boris to stay as Prime Minister because I can see every day he stays the damage that he's doing, the damage he's doing to our international reputation, to public confidence. And I think it's very difficult to see how, if he's losing confidence in the country, potentially losing confidence amongst his own MPs, how he's going to be able to push forward any kind of agenda to deliver the things that we really need to see. We've got a cost of living crisis. We need to move much faster towards net zero. How can he do that when he has been so damaged and discredited?
Well, one clear issue that voters are going to be thinking about is not just the lockdown. I mean, the endless comparisons between what I was doing, you know, or what one was doing during that lockdown, memories of that, and the comparison with what Downing Street might have been doing. But there's also, as you say, the cost of living crisis. Joseph Rowntree Foundation showing that low-income households will spend almost a fifth of their income after housing costs on energy bills starting in April, when the price cap is going to be lifted. This is a massive government nationwide crisis that is just, you know, weeks away from hitting all of us.
Absolutely. And it really, I'm sure I share with many MPs a real anxiety about the impact that that's going to have on some of my low-income constituents. And that's why I'm saying, you know, we needed to have taken net zero seriously and made a real effort to get more homes insulated. We know that that's a major step on the path to net zero. And if we'd done more, if the Green Homes Grant that the government had introduced a few years ago had been more successful, if there'd been more political will around getting some of these things delivered, we could already have had thousands, possibly a million homes.
But it's the cost. It's the cost of that for government and for individuals. It's so expensive to insulate your home and to make all of these measures, to buy a brand new boiler. It's huge costs for individuals.
No, I agree with that. I agree with that. My point is only if we had made more of, if the government had had a clearer strategy to start with and had been prepared to invest more in that. And they were prepared to invest in that. It was just a very poorly executed programme, which has now had to be scrapped, and we're right back to where we were. But, I mean, they won't even introduce new standards for new homes that make them carbon neutral. So, you know, it's kind of like there is much more that could be done that hasn't been done, and we really do need to see much more action on that soon, just to try and that would do more than anything else to try and manage down some of the bills that households are facing.
The Liberal Democrats have got clear policy on climate change. In the past, you've called for the cost of carbon to be more properly incorporated into electricity bills, which is effectively calling for gas and electricity to be more expensive. Do you now support the taxpayer stepping in to subsidise bills to keep them down?
Well, what we've been calling for is a windfall tax on the oil and gas and the gas wholesalers who are currently making enormous profits off the back of wholesale prices. And what we're asking for is a windfall tax, and that would help to fund a warm homes discount for a much larger number of households than currently qualify for it. And that would have an immediate impact in helping our middle and lower income households through the current crisis of higher energy bills.
Yeah, which is going to be a big deal in the next few months. Just want to talk to you about the other, you know, major issue. I know everyone wants to forget about the virus and the pandemic, but it is still with us. The Guardian, I mean, don't we? The Guardian reports the government is considering ending mandatory isolation altogether in March. Is that the end point, in your view?
It's difficult to say where we're going to be in March. It seems rather extraordinary to be making predictions now of where we're going to be. I have to say, I do think that the most recent picture is very encouraging in terms of both cases going downwards, and certainly in London, and certainly seems to be happening in other parts of the country as well, and also hospitalisations. I think hospitalisations for Omicron have not been nearly as bad as we potentially feared a couple of months ago, and that's certainly very much to be welcomed. I just think, though, we need to continue to be cautious because there's still the risk out there of new variants that might not be as mild as Omicron turned out to be. We just need to continue to exercise caution. So I think it's much too soon to be saying, we'll lift this restriction then or stop doing this, this, that and the other at some other time. I think masks on public transport and in shops have been widely adopted. People seem fairly happy with that. And it seems silly to lift restrictions for the sake of lifting restrictions when actually continued caution seems to be much better indicated. But I will say, obviously, vaccines, everybody should get their jabs, everybody should get their boosters, and it is really, really clear that that is what has made the difference, certainly in this country, to beating the virus. And we just need to make sure that everybody continues to come forward for that and have access to that.
Well, let's have a look at what else is making news in the world of politics today. The government has suffered a series of defeats in the House of Lords over the controversial police crime sentencing and courts bill. Opposition peers voted against plans to give police new powers to stop protests if they deemed them to be too noisy or too disruptive. The Lords also voted to make misogyny a hate crime in England and Wales. The Tory former minister, Baroness Altman, said that without these amendments from the Lords, the legislation could be a, quote, Trojan horse, allowing future governments to introduce the shadow of repression, and that they were possibly a threat to democracy.
Well, the BBC reports the UK is supplying Ukraine with weapons to defend itself against the threat from Russia. Defence Secretary Ben Wallace says short-range anti-tank missiles will be sent and a small team of British soldiers will go to Ukraine to provide training. He says there is real cause for concern that the Russian troops amassed on Ukraine's border could be used for an invasion.
And just lastly, despite a surge in Omicron cases last month, Britain's jobs market grew robustly. The number of people on company payrolls rose by 184,000 in December. That was much stronger than the pace that was anticipated. The jobless rate also dropped to 4.1% in the quarter through November. That is the best reading since June 2020. So actually, at least the jobs market looking good.
Well, let's get to our next guest now. From this week, the self-isolation period in England for people with COVID symptoms or a positive test result has been cut from 7 days to 5. Now, it's the second time in less than 4 weeks that the government has reduced the self-isolation period as employers battle with high levels of staff absence. But does the move make sense from a disease prevention standpoint? Well, joining us now is Sally Cutler, Professor in Medical Microbiology at the University of East London. Sally, thanks so much for joining us on the programme today. Now, you've written about your concerns over this change. Why does it worry you?
Well, it worries me in the fact that we're now turning our attention away from the scientific data and really sort of going along with what the economy and societal pressures are suggesting is the right route to follow. And so we've had this switch from the scientific data along to other priorities. Now, the scientific data hasn't actually changed. And when you look at the viral infection, in the majority of individuals, the viral infection starts off with a very low level of virus present in the upper respiratory tract, and then that increases and increases, and that peaks between days 3 to 6, and then it begins to tail off and drop down until about day 10, when pretty well everybody is no longer shedding infectious virus anymore. And so This is why we had that 10-day isolation period. That hasn't changed. And the fact that we've now suddenly reduced from 7 days isolation and then now to 5 days isolation, but with that reliance on, you must have a couple of negative lateral flow tests, that is putting a lot of pressure on the individual members of the public to actually correctly do those lateral flow tests, if they can actually get their hands on a lateral flow test.
Okay, but the research suggests that even at the height of the pandemic, many people didn't follow the rules, and presumably compliance is even lower now. So does it serve, you know, any purpose, really? I mean, surely at least if you could get people to self-isolate for 5 days, that would be at least something that would prevent the spread of COVID.
Well, absolutely. And you're always going to get the population pretty well divided on those who follow the rules and those who ignore the rules. And I'm afraid as we're going further and further into the pandemic time-wise, people are fatigued. They want to clutch on to some resemblance to normality again. And so a lot of people are not following the guidance. You can walk into supermarkets now while we're currently under Plan B rules, and there'll still be lots of people not wearing face masks. And you keep thinking, well, that many people surely can't actually be exempt from the need to wear face masks. Mm. So people don't follow the rules, but we also see the rules changing every week. And so people are going to think, well, it was that rule this week, and now it's changed to this. Why? And if it can change and be halved from 10 days to 5 days in just a matter of weeks, then what are those rules actually based on? Is it all a load of nonsense?
You're right that the data supports a full 10-day isolation period, but surely having huge numbers of people off work with few symptoms or no symptoms at all would be massively inefficient. There must be some kind of balance between stopping the virus and keeping the economy running.
Well, absolutely. And I fully understand that it's a juggling act between all of these different priorities, between the health priorities, between societal needs, economic needs as well. So it is very much a juggling act. But we've been following the scientific data for so long now, and to see this sudden transition, actually, let's ignore the scientific data. Let's go and think about the economic needs and the pressures there, keep the economy going. And so we've seen this switch from basically following the science to following the political requirements.
Okay, but let me pick you up on that point. Were we ever really following the science? The government clung to what became a kind of a mantra, a phrase, but the science that a lot of the decisions were made on was not clear cut. I mean, there is a debate within the scientific community. There was a lot around modelling and what the future may hold, and that again is subject to what sort of input data you plug in. So it was always just a government mantra, the idea of sticking to the science, wasn't it?
Well, remember, the scientists are learning too. And we're being challenged with new variants, with different sort of infectiousness and all kinds of different things. We're also looking at sort of other challenges such as the vaccination rollout. And so our ways of actually fighting and controlling the infection within the community. And that in itself is a whole series of different problems, in the fact that you've got sort of the richer countries in the world that have got really good vaccination rates, and yet the poorer countries in the world, many of them, they're sort of struggling to hit 10% of people with two shots of the vaccine, which is absolutely appalling when you're thinking about trying to control what is a global pandemic. And so we need a global response to that, not just sort of, oh, let's give all the vaccines and the protection to the rich countries and not to the poorer ones. So there are many, many challenges, and we're learning as we go. And there are so many things that haven't quite panned out as have been predicted, but it is that learning journey for all of us.
You mentioned fatigue over the rules. I mean, it's been 2 years now. The Guardian reports that the government's considering ending mandatory isolation altogether in March. Don't you feel that we're sort of getting towards that end point, or we should be getting towards that end point now that we have a much milder strain of the virus?
Well, whether it's milder or not is a matter of debate. What you're looking at is a virus that's now circulating in a population that has quite a considerable degree of protection through either prior infection or through vaccination. And this is why it's presenting as a much milder infection, because you've got that degree of protection already in the community. So this is on the road to living with COVID. Mm-hmm. But what we've had with Omicron is we've had this very, very different variant. And so even people that have been previously infected with Delta, for instance, were all succumbing to infection with Omicron. And so we had this massive synchronized group of infection all at the same time. And so there's weeks between Christmas and New Year, and so many people, their unwanted Christmas present was COVID. And so literally, the decimation that we saw with Omicron was due to the fact that so many people got their infection at that same point in time.
The hospitalization rates are much lower, though, aren't they, with this wave?
Thankfully, and that is largely through the good rollout we've had with vaccines. And so we need to think about developing and evolving those vaccines too, because as we're seeing, they're less effective against Omicron, and we may see new variants in the future that come through, which again might be less protected against with the current vaccine. So we need to evolve the vaccine.
Yeah.
We maybe need to actually go from the sort of monovariant to polyvariant vaccines, which would be a natural progression. And we maybe need to further look in the longer term at developing vaccines that are better stimulating what's an upper respiratory tract, a mucosal immunity, as opposed to something that you inject and give what's known as systemic whole body protection against the virus.
So, yeah, developing the vaccines, and this may be a long-term project, you know, a bit like the flu vaccine every year or even more frequently. Sally, what do you make... I want to ask you just briefly about the political situation. Boris Johnson and the furore about Partygate... In your view, as a scientist, how much damage does this do, you know, when government is flouting rules that are rolled out to the rest of the population? And pretty much everyone up and down the country is thinking about that and feels quite strongly about it, it seems.
Absolutely, as I do too. And I think, quite honestly, there has to be strong leadership, and you cannot have one rule for one set of people and another rule for others. We talked a little bit earlier about this poor compliance with rules and regulations. Well, with the kind of leadership we're getting at this point in time, is it surprising that people are saying, oh, I can't be bothered anymore. I've had enough. I'm not going to follow those rules. They don't. And so basically, why should I have to follow the rules? So of course people are going to be sort of very sort of casual about whether they actually follow guidance and rules or not. But that's the example we're being given at the moment, and it's an appalling mess.
Bloomberg Westminster. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.